CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
Before we get started, I'd like to thank our sponsors. Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management, and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. Also, Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter. And finally, National Association of Corporate Directors, an association created for directors by directors, whose mission is to advance exemplary board leadership. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And in this week's CFO Radio News, we have an article that's been published by Bloomberg News, Acquisitions of Small Businesses on the Rise. When Johnny Huynh was looking to raise money for his San Francisco social media marketing company last year, he found a much better way to expand: sell it. Huynh's six-month-old startup company, Damn the Radio Inc., was acquired by FanBridge on New Year's Eve for a price in the quote-unquote low seven figures, Huynh said. Damn the Radio helps companies like Warner Music Group Corp. and Sony Corp. and bands like Linkin Park create media-rich Facebook fan pages. The sale made sense from a product level and a business level, said Huynh, who is now Vice President of Business Development for FanBridge. We're pretty stoked. Huynh isn't alone. The number of small businesses being acquired is increasing this year as the economy recovers from the recession, according to firms that monitor the transactions. It really picked up in January, said Peter Siegel, founder of BizBen.com, a website that lists about 7,000 small and medium-sized businesses for sale. I think there was just pent-up demand. A lot of buyers have come into the market because the prices are so low and they want to pick up some bargains. In terms of acquisitions rise, in January, 62 small and mid-sized businesses changed hands in San Francisco, almost double the 34 deals that closed a year earlier, according to BizBen.com. For all of 2010, 535 companies sold, compared with 502 in 2009. Siegel says 2011 should see more gains. I'm projecting a 30% increase over last year, he said. The number of failing firms has declined as well. Small business bankruptcies fell 18% nationally in the fourth quarter from a year earlier, according to a report by Equifax, Inc. It was the sixth straight quarter of declines since peaking in the second quarter of 2009, which is great news for the consumer. Part of the gain in small business purchases in 2010 was due to an increase in lending guarantees from the U.S. Small Business Administration, which supports companies through loan programs and disaster assistance, said Mark Quinn, director of the agency's San Francisco District Office. Nationally, the SBA lent more than $10.4 billion in the quarter ended December 31. That's the largest quarter of lending we've ever done in history, Quinn said. Just in December, we did $1 billion of lending in California alone. Well, on from the topic of acquisitions to our guest today, Mark Reed is joining us as the Chief Financial Officer of Infomentis, Inc., which was recently acquired by the Taz Group. Prior to this, Mark was Vice President Investments of Industrial Development International, Inc., responsible for asset management, financing and dispositions for an industrial development and land portfolios company in the Midwest and Midwest and Western states. Previous to this, Mark held a variety of positions within the mortgage industry and in real estate. And Mark began his career with Arthur Andersen and Company, where he was responsible for planning, designing, and implementing business information systems for various clients. Mark has an MBA from the University of Florida and a Bachelor of Science in Marketing from the University of Alabama. Well, goodness, Mark, that's quite a lot of background already. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, Mark, let's start at the beginning. What was your first job?
My first job
Maybe was it selling frogs? Was it selling lemonade on the stands?
Actually, my first job was loading beer trucks for their deliveries in a very hot warehouse.
Did you get paid in product?
sort of. I may not say it. That was the 70s. So.
Formally no, right?
Yes.
So how did you get from loading trucks with beer products to chief financial officer of Infomentis Inc.? What was the path from then to now?
Well, obviously, after college, getting a job at Arthur Andersen in the consulting division, it was it's a great opportunity. It opens your eyes to a lot of different opportunities in the market. And I was fortunate enough to have three real estate engagements. And I had also taken some real estate courses in graduate school. So so that was the obvious path. And my forte through the next, you know, few years of my career was financial analysis, financing, acquisitions analysis of real estate projects, lease analysis. And so I built my reputation as a financial person in that arena.
Now, that's a bit of a hop, skip, and jump from marketing. Your undergraduate degree is in marketing. What caused you to go from marketing into finance as part of your MBA and then into Andersen, Arthur Andersen? Why not marketing?
Well, my eyes were really opened. In 1982, when I graduated with my marketing degree, the prime interest rate was 18% and the economy was really tanked. And the last thing that companies were doing were hiring marketing people. That's the first thing that that goes. So I elected to go to graduate school. I figured, well, I can complement my marketing degree with a financial degree.
Had you had a financial acumen up until that point?
Yes, I did well in finance and accounting in undergrad, and so I thought this would be, a good marketing package, finance and marketing, and I really enjoyed it when I went to the next level of detail in graduate school, and also with the real estate finance courses that I had picked up. So
and real estate was hot in the 80s.
Very hot, and I thought that this would be a great way to grow and ride that
the big wave, huh?
Ride that big wave.
So there was some money focus there as well, huh?
Oh yes.
You know, it's interesting. I remember reading and being taught Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where the money that you were paid for your job was really lower on the rankings. And in the first year of university, I remember all of us took some kind of a test that was meant to give you your propensity on a personal level as to affiliating with the Maslow hierarchy of needs, and you know, the basics of food and water and all those different things, and then the social comforts, and then essentially desire for the job was kind of high up on the list. By the time we got to our fourth year, the money element of it was actually lesser because we had all worked out in industry for a year. And so here we are. You're starting out with the initial, as everybody does, want to work hard, want to be compensated for what we do. And then you're going out into the industry and you're helping companies look at the finance aspects of real estate, a booming market. Was it exciting?
Very exciting, especially working for some of the developers in the 80s and early 90s. It's, almost like the Wild Wild West in terms of watching some of these real estate developers make deals and really almost go on their gut. And, of course, I'm the finance guy telling them, well, you really need to look at these other factors when you make this deal, but it was fairly interesting.
Did you find that some of those decisions, the financial analysis was perhaps base level information, but decisions were made on the gut?
Yes, a lot of times, deals would be broad brush put together. And it was a gut feeling like, yes, this land acquisition is a great deal. And I know it's going to work based on, past experience. But, bringing in the financial analysis side of it to say, okay, Well, let's look at, you know, at a projection over 5 years to see how that land will be taken down, how you'll sell it, what the interest carry is, the property taxes, et cetera. And that really did open the eyes of the developer in a lot of instances.
Understand. Well, how did you get from there to Chief Financial Officer of Informentis? Tell us a little bit about that path.
Okay. Well, in the mid-90s, I was working with Industrial Developments International, and my wife was also working in software sales, and she basically accidentally founded the company. A former employee of hers from another company said, "Hey, why don't you come out and make a presentation on the sales skills training that you taught me?"
And is that what Informentis is about, sales training?
Yes, Informentis started as a sales training company. And based on that presentation, she actually won the business, but she didn't even have a business to start off with. So so she scrambled, created a course, and you know, we're working out of the living room of our house, and was able to start the company. The company that we were presenting to actually gave us $80,000 up front to work off, knowing that we did not have a company. So so in moonlighting hours, we're working on this company. I'm helping on the company setup, the financial side of the company, the legal side, and my wife was working on the actual product and
the marketing. So I would imagine business started to boom.
Yes. We incorporated in April 96, and by the end of 1996, we had $1 million in sales, just over $1 million in sales, which was crazy. And so so following really 96, early 97, I thought, okay, it looks like we could probably put all our eggs in one basket. And I thought, okay, well, I'll get out of the real estate profession for a while and get this business going, and I can always come back to it. And interestingly enough, I never went back because the business was a lot of fun, and it was just a great ride. For
you got out of it at a good time.
Yes, yes, got out of it a great time.
Well, you went from essentially that role to that of being a CFO. That's a quick, fast jump. And I would imagine that being that your background was in the financial side rather than the accounting side, was that a benefit to you in terms of starting up a business? Did you need to go and get some loans to be able to create that opportunity, or were your customers helping fund you through that cash up front?
Yes, the working capital initially was being funded through customers, but based on their payment, how they would pay, we did have to go out and get working capital, you know, line of credit tied to accounts receivable.
How is that different when it's your own money and your own debt?
It definitely keeps you up at night. Initially, we had to put our house on the line as collateral, but for a couple of years, and then we were able to get that removed. But that was basically us putting our business on the line, and really our personal finances on the line as well. But we felt good based on the clients that we had. All of our clients were publicly traded companies. We knew they were going to pay. So in terms of backing up an accounts receivable line, felt pretty comfortable doing that. But
and what length of contracts did you have at that time? Was it 12-month contracts with these companies, or 2-year, 3-year contracts?
They really were open-ended contracts. The way the training industry, at least back then in the 90s, the way the training industry bought training, is you would have a contract, which basically would be a license to operate within the company. It just kind of defined confidentiality terms, payment terms, and just general kind of the framework of business terms. The statements of work, however, would have to be sold on an individual basis, and those would have, say, time frames attached to those.
And were they long in duration? Was that what gave you the comfort to take out the private debt and to extend your credit?
They weren't long in duration, but they were consistent. The business was consistent. And based on kind of our early model in selling into these larger companies, high-tech companies, we found that people that we knew or had sold to at these companies were very transient, and so they would go to other companies and call us up, and we would get new business that way. So we felt confident that we, through, say, the first year, if we trained, I think we trained like maybe 600-700 people the first year. So we seeded the market fairly well, because those 700 a year later, even though they might have been only with
200 large, of them were elsewhere, and that company now needed you.
Right. So it was quite the exciting time for that. But my skills rolling over from kind of the financial analysis and of real estate and projections rolled over nicely into the business. So so I could come up with some business plans. I could come up with projections. And more importantly, I had experience dealing with banks. And so that helped us launch our business.
That helped you launch your business. Well, Mark, you're a CFO of a small privately held company that recently sold. What advice would you give to other business owners who contemplate selling their business someday?
I think it's very important to always have your business due diligence ready to sell. The discipline of keeping all your files intact, all the intellectual property, trademarks, service marks, patents, everything in one location, all your contracts have to have signatures, and they have to be complete, employee files, NDAs, confidentiality and invention agreements papered with the employee files. And really, if your business is IP based, you really have to have the IP protections in place in your contracts and throughout the whole business, everything that you do.
And did you employ that expertise of an outside intellectual property attorney to help you with that?
Yes. Probably about 5 years after we started the business, we changed attorneys to one that specialized in intellectual property, because we knew that's what the value of the business would be, is in the intellectual property and the protection of that.
And obviously you're in a service industry, so that being said, your business is the people, your business is the leaders, mm-hmm. Those that you are a training company, so you're training your own employees to go out and train others. Was there, if you will, a structure to that training, and that's the intellectual property that you're describing?
Yes. When we would train our own instructors or independent consultants that were out in other markets, we had an onboarding process where we would certify them to teach our intellectual property, and also how to protect our intellectual property in terms of, not leaving training books behind at training locations, making sure that if somebody were to sit in on a workshop or session that that they sign an NDA, if it's somebody that was not a registered participant. So
And this was sales training. You're training people to sell.
Yes. Quite simply, we trained people how to get customers and keep customers. A lot of it kind of focused around opportunity management and account planning.
So when did you sell the business? How recent was it?
December 2010.
So you're still perhaps on the hiatus of that acquisition. Was it fun? Was the sale itself fun?
It was, I wouldn't say fun. I would say it was very, very frantic and I would go ahead and say stressful as well, only for the fact that we had a short time fuse from the time that the prospective purchaser, who was actually a business partner of ours, said they wanted to buy the business. We had 60 days to close.
So tell us a little bit about that. Had you put your business up for what I would describe as the dog and pony show of we're available for sale? Or did somebody just come to you and say, hey, let's have a discussion?
It was, hey, let's have a discussion. And interestingly enough, over our almost 15-year run, we had many inquisitors.
People that were inquiring about whether they could buy your company?
Right. When the roll-ups were big in the late 90s, we had somebody contact us, and we went through that iteration with them, kind of.
Did you have a term sheet?
Had a term sheet, but it was one of those things. We were early on our growth curve, and we decided not to do it. But it was a great exercise. And not long after that, we had an angel investor that was interested in investing money in us. And so that was another interesting exercise to go through. We didn't take the money. There was a couple... It happened a couple other times in terms of there was a time when we had a training partner of ours, somebody else that we worked with that was not a competitor. Their material was very complimentary to ours. We went through the exercise of considering a merger.
So why did you not do any of these deals?
You know, it's... early on, it was, you know, we thought, gee, we can grow and do this on our own and create the value that we were looking for. As we kind of progressed, it was interesting. It was like we really liked our lifestyle as a small company. And we would assess like, well, gee, what are we giving up here? Because, if we're going to be acquired, we might be working for somebody else. We might lose some of the, benefits of owning your own business. It's kind of all those doubts that come into your mind sometimes.
I would imagine the night that you went to bed leaving X million dollar check on the table that you said, no thanks. Did you sleep?
Yeah, it's, definitely kept us thinking at night. It was definitely an eye-opening experience.
Wow. Well, were there any gotchas that came as surprises at any time during the sale process or even the due diligence? As you talk about these gotchas, if there were any, how did you handle them?
Okay. First I'd like to say it wasn't so much of a gotcha, but I think it's just the trend in the industry. We realized that everything is going virtual due diligence rooms. And so through this process, we had a lot of our due diligence scanned into files, virtual files. All of our contracts were filed that way, but everything else due diligence related was not. So there was a huge effort in the due diligence process to scan everything, all our corporate records, the trademarks, everything. So it was in the virtual room, and all the attorneys could have access to it. And I think that is where the industry, legal industry, I think that's where it's going. It's very accepted to have now all your signed documents, in kind of a virtual file room.
And you said all the attorneys. How many attorneys were at the table?
Well, two firms, but you know they have their teams. Since we were closing on such a short time frame, you know everybody's scrambling, you know, for going through the whole due diligence list on the acquisition side. Obviously, they're reviewing and asking questions, and they have a whole team pouring through all the documents we're supplying them. And then on our side, you know, we have our in-house team that's answering questions and you know, dealing with you know, issues on certain documents or researching items and dealing with our own team at our law firm. So
just out of curiosity, can you remember the magnitude of dollar amount that you paid for your attorneys to do that kind of work?
Yes. It was $120,000.
And how long were the attorneys there? Was it
That's for 2 months worth of work. Wow. And there was some follow-on work, you know, after we closed, but not
so
much.
So as a company, you've gone through the term process a couple of times, the term sheet process. You've gone through somebody looking to invest in you, and you said, no thanks. Then you went through a potential merger and all the ramifications that go through that, and you said, no thanks. And now you're paying a substantial amount of money to an attorney's firm. Was it different this time? Did you think, yes, we're in a mindset where we're going to do this? Or could things have been such that you paid the money and then you pulled out?
No, we had the mindset like this is a great deal. And we really we knew the company that was acquiring us because they were a business partner, worked really well with them. And so that really helped in negotiations and making it basically as pleasant as a process as you could make it. You know, I really wasn't any kind of thought like, okay, we're going to pull out. The only thing that would get us would be a gotcha, a deal killer. And there was one basically deal killer that popped up.
And, can you say what that was?
Yes. We had a couple of distributors that we had set up in London and one in South America, and we had set them up as almost like a franchise. They were branded as Infomenis. Their company name was Infomenis, say Latin America or Infomenis Limited, you know, since they were in the UK, and we gave them exclusives. For their territory. So South America was exclusive to the one obviously based in South America, Colombia. And then the one based in London had Europe and part of the Middle East. And so when we did that deal, we thought, well, this is a great deal. And we were fine to give them an exclusive. What we didn't think of was on the exit side, what would be the ramifications. And so the issue was the TAS group, they already had offices in these countries and salespeople and independent consultants. And so so these contracts were assignable. They went with the acquisition and they see the exclusivity and they go, well, we can't have this because, you know, we already have people in these countries. So we had to go to the distributors and say, you know, this acquisition is going to be good for you because not only are you going to be selling Infomenis products, but you're going to be selling the TAS Group products and you'll be making more money. So our South American partner understood that and he signed a document basically giving up the exclusivity and he was happy with that. The London group, however, was a bit more difficult. They weren't going to do that. And so we were faced with, you know, the transaction, you know, basically cratering, and if they didn't do this. So, it took us about 2 weeks within that 60-day window. We kept moving ahead with all the due diligence items and moving toward close, but 2 weeks of, a lot of you know, phone calls back and forth, conference calls, attorneys going back and forth trying to work this out, And, you know, at the end of the day, we were finally able to convince the group in London to give up the exclusivity. But they were, because they were wanting compensation for it, and they had their attorneys involved. And actually, the $120,000 that I mentioned to you, probably about 30 of that was attributed just to this issue going back and forth.
In retrospect, do you wish that you might have had some language in the contract with those distributors for the potential acquisition of your company? That very often is standard language.
Yes. We did have the language in there in terms of being the contract being assignable and all that, but what we missed was, and what my advice would be to other people would be very careful granting exclusives, anything that you can't, that's going to be hard to unwind.
Hindsight is 20/20 vision, yes. And you would do that a little bit different. Well, in the most recent role as CFO, you were responsible for all legal-related issues for the company. We're talking about some of those. You were responsible for managing the outside relationships with your counsel. What are some of the valuable tips that you would pass along to another CFO regarding that liaison with legal counsel and that outside advisor?
A couple of things. I think, especially in a small company environment, to manage your expense with outside counsel, you really have to have some procedures within the company of who's actually calling the attorney. You don't want to have it where you have multiple people in the company just picking up the phone and calling an attorney because they have an issue that they want to ask them about. Because obviously, they charge basically for anything, any call that comes in. So at our company, we set myself up as kind of the point person that if anybody had any legal type questions, they would run them by me first. And a lot of times I'd be able to answer those questions or solve whatever the issue was before we had to escalate it to an attorney.
And how does that translate to the bill that you get?
Well, you know, the bill would be less if I'm the only one that is contacting the law firm.
You can manage the cost structure.
I can manage the cost, and mm-hmm. so then I would only pick up the phone if it truly was a legal issue that that was above really my knowledge. If it was above a business issue and it was more of a legal issue. If a client, say, wanted to change some terms in kind of the liability section of the contract, that's kind of a sensitive area that I say, okay, I need to have an attorney's opinion on this.
Sure, sure. Now, as part of that due diligence, I'd like to focus on something that you said in terms of all of our employees picking up the phone. Sometimes the sale of a company is confidential, and perhaps the business owners and those that are investors are maybe the only ones that know, plus the CFO. It sounds as if your employees or some of your employees more broadly knew that you were going through the sale. Who did you tell, and how did you handle the legality of them potentially disclosing this?
That's a great question. We didn't tell anybody initially through the kind of the negotiations.
So just you and your wife.
Yes, and
so this was kind of cloak and dagger behind closed door, meeting at hotels, that sort of stuff.
Yes, yes, and I think some folks were wondering what was going on because these guys were business partners. It was not totally out of the realm of,
it was a possibility that
right.
was out there.
So when they came to our office, it wasn't that big of a deal. However, the longer the doors are closed, the more people wonder. And that's just kind of how it works in an office environment. People are saying, gee, I wonder what's going on in there.
And very often in this scenario, and I've been involved in multiple transactions, you tend to get the suits, whereas the company that perhaps you had relationships with before, their dress might have been a little bit more casual. Lawyers just have a look and feel about them, and the briefcase is always a little bit too shiny and the leather's a little too expensive. Mm-hmm. It amazes me that when you've got non-disclosures, and very often what you do is you have your employees that know sign a non-disclosure and a very tightly wrapped confidentiality around it. But other employees, they pick up on that one suit walking down the hallway with a briefcase like grease lightning.
Oh yes, everybody definitely is talking, you know, back talking, so to speak. Interesting. Our accounting manager was definitely onto something, because she had been through this drill before, because she had been with us for so many years. So when you know, there's question when I go in and I make a request, like, I need this report or that report, and can you pull this together? Then
her radar was going up.
The radar, yes. Okay, this sounds familiar, and so anyway.
Well, that's interesting. Did you have your employees, when you told them, sign a confidentiality agreement?
Actually, no. You know, that's a good point. We never.
They had a broad confidentiality agreement for the business, which is what you've already mentioned.
Right.
But there was nothing specific to the sale that you put in place.
No, and actually, the employees, we didn't tell the employees about the acquisition until we had a signed contract.
Got it. So you had that letter of intent.
Right. But once we it was actually until we had the letter of intent, but the actual
beyond
contract.
That, the actual once contract we signed, sale.
Once we signed the letter of intent, we did tell the management team of the business, because obviously they're
going to be impacted.
They're going to be
impacted,
and
they're now going to be part of that latest second part of the due diligence.
That's right.
Yeah,
and they were incented to be part of, work hard towards getting the transaction closed, because we did have an option plan at the company. So
their incentive was to make sure that the best foot was put forward, right?
Yes.
Wonderful. Well, let's talk. You're talking about employees. We're talking about their incentives. That is a fabulous segue into our next question. Let's talk a little bit about compensation plans in your business. Tell us how you structured compensation plans. You were a sales organization, so I would imagine that was key for you, compensation for the sales and management team. And how did you motivate the behavior to maximize not only top-line revenue, but bottom-line earnings?
Okay. As it relates to the sales team, over the years, we learned a lot in terms of, you know, how to structure comp plans to motivate the right behaviors. What the experience early was based on our prior experience with our other companies and other sales compensation plans. But specific to our needs as a small business, we needed to manage our margins, our gross margin, and then the bottom line. And so the best plan that we had come up with was a plan based on commissions tied to margins. And so what we did, through everything a salesperson could sell, all the services and all the, say, software, intellectual property, we assigned a cost basis. And it was loosely tied to kind of our cost of goods sold, but more so in terms of kind of an analysis. We looked at, okay, what's the deepest discount that we as a company would give for this particular service or this particular IP? And with that deep discount, how much would we be able to pay in commission? And so that's how we came up with kind of a standard kind of cost basis for all these services.
And was that a sliding scale? So, for example, on the first... 100,000 that they sold, they'd get 2%, and then the next 100,000, they'd get 2.2%, and then the next 100,000, they'd get 2.3%. Were they incented for that extra sale more than they were the first sale?
Yes, yes, definitely. They had a tiered commission structure. They also had cash bonuses at gates over quota, and also a cash bonus at quota. So they so the idea is to incent them to get to quota, and get that cash reward, and then instead of ratcheting up the percentage over quota, we would throw big cash bonuses for each gate. So say $20,000 for every $250,000 of sales over quota, and it was unlimited. We didn't put a cap on it, and so.
Did you have some salespeople that were just out there knocking it well out of the park?
Oh, yeah. We had one individual that made over $1 million 3 years in a row. And it's a great recruiting tool. And that truly was an outlier. But the idea is, in the recruiting side, is, you know, if you're going to offer somebody kind of maybe a lower than market base salary, but you show them the ability to overachieve, you know, here's what you can make when you overachieve. It's kind of like, you know, that's the aha moment for them. They go, wow, that sounds like a great opportunity. And so we really tried to set our salespeople up as almost like business owner mentality. So we gave them titles called client partners is what their titles were. And by setting them up where they get commission based on the margin that they got on a deal, that would incent them to obviously maximize the best price. So we called it the self-managing plan, which was great because they didn't have to come to us for, approvals on discounts.
Because they were basically hitting their own pocket.
Right. If you deeply discount the deal, you might not make much money. But you can run your own numbers, and if, you know, if it's a large deal, you might be willing to discount it to obviously make the money over the long haul.
Sure, sure. And was that compensation structure also based on cash coming in, or were you the one funding the working capital on that? For example, did the sales rep or client partner? Partner client get the cash after the company paid you, or did you front them the money and then your customer paid?
We only paid them when the money came in, and so that it was the self-managing accounts receivable plan as well. So they were incented to work with the accounting department and get
help with the collections
which was great. The other thing that we instituted is the commissions would start to decrease after 90 days. So if the money did not come in within 90 days, their commissions would be cut by 25%. If it didn't come in after 120 days, the commissions would be cut by half. And
that is pretty severe. I don't think I've ever seen a plan that has that. Well, everything up until this point, I've seen compensation plans that have that. But cutting the commission because the customer didn't pay on time?
Well, because the client...
I love it.
The client partner controls that, right?
Right.
He has the relationships. He needs to make that happen. Now, there were some instances where we did not enforce that. For instance, we were dealing with a subsidiary out of Malaysia of a large multinational company. And... Malaysia was very hard to deal with, and try, you know, there's like the government's really somehow they have their hands in that whole process, and to get money from them was very painful. So that was really out of the salesperson's control.
Sure, sure. Yeah, when you deal with governments, there's not a lot that one person in the U.S. can do for a Malaysian government.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, as a CFO, what keeps you up at night?
Well, it's all those unforeseen gotchas that'll pop up that just come out of left field that you're like, okay, where did this come from?
It's the risk that you didn't plan for.
Right. For instance, we had an insurance broker that we used for all of our business insurance. So for, employee liability insurance, professional liability insurance, he handled all of our business insurance. So we paid him, I believe it was slightly over $100,000, for the premiums that were due, because he's the agent, right? So we pay him the premium. Don't think anything of it. We're sleeping well at night. Then one day come in the office and, insurance company calls us and says they haven't gotten their payment. And so we call the broker and the agent, his assistant that we normally dealt with on a day-to-day basis said, we have not seen him around the office.
So Johnny did a runner.
Yes. And apparently he had some...
With your $100,000.
Yes. And so we had to deal with the insurance commissioner and all this business, and he went to trial and he went to jail. And we, early on I thought, well, there might be some way we could get this money back, but apparently he did it to a whole bunch of other companies and there really wasn't any money to be had because all this money was gone. So who would have ever thought, talk about what keeps you up at night. Who would ever thought that would hit you? You're thinking, oh my gosh. but guess what? The insurance companies didn't get paid. We still had to pay them. So we double paid for insurance for that year.
Wow.
Which was very painful.
Wow.
Very painful.
So did you ever think about taking on a personal lawsuit to get it back from the individual?
There wasn't anything there. And,
You spent the money.
Oh, yeah. It was all gambling related.
Oh, my goodness. That would keep you up at night.
And the interesting thing with this guy is we had been working with him for over 10 years. And there never had been any kind of problem. And so it must have been something recent in his life that he just got sidetracked.
Interesting that you say that, Mark. A couple of weeks ago on our radio show, the news article was from a study that KPMG did about the statistics of who commits fraud. And I teach ethics at some local universities here in Atlanta, and I use typically FBI statistics. Well, the two have merged into being very, very closely aligned. KPMG's recent study indicated that the first-time fraudster is somebody in the finance aspects of the company, i.e. they have access to the cash, and typically they have been an employee for more than 10 years. And he's a male between, I think it's the ages of 36 and 45, or 44. So what you've just said is the exact statistic.
Fits the profile, yes.
It fits the profile. Mm-hmm. So be careful of your agent relationships that are more than 10 years as well. Well, Mark, I hate to do this. We are nearing the end of the show, but as we do so, we have one last question. We have a tradition on the show to ask CFO Tip of the Month. What is your CFO Tip of the Month?
It's probably a little out of the ordinary. I would say my biggest tip would be to hire from what I call the mom network. At our company, we had a handful of, I call moms. They were professionals, worked in whatever their particular industry was for years, very smart, intelligent. Then they decided to have children, left the workforce, raise their kids, then their kids are in school, and guess what? They kind of want to get back into it. And it was great for us to handle, kind of like ebbs and flows of workloads and business. We started off having a part-time HR person who was previously a professional in HR. Worked out great for us. Same thing in the accounting department. We had two CPAs that came in on a part-time basis when we would do our audits and help out with just general overflow of activity. So I thought that was a great way to fill the need with some excellent professionals.
Well, that's fabulous. Thank you very much. That's a great tip, Mark. And formally, I'd like to thank Mark Reed for being our guest today. Thank you, Mark, for sharing your innermost thoughts on the role of the CFO. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks also go to our contributor, Bloomberg News, and to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, go to DelaneyLLC.com. Thanks to Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and financial executives. See their website at financialexecutives.org. And to National Association of Corporate Directors, advancing exemplary board leadership for directors by directors. See their website at nacdonline.org. This and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO and would like to be a guest on the show, we'd love to hear from you. Please contact us via the web. Thanks for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off until next time.